So I think my presentation is going to be slightly different. I'm going to focus more on comparisons between the terrestrial and the marine. It's going to be about the plankton. I am sorry for all the benthos, but it's my field. And also I'm going to focus on basically two aspects that I'm interested in. So it's going to be mainly about density, well, prey-predator mass ratios and the light effect. So you see when it's changing? You can follow it? Yeah, okay. So basically the first difference between the sea and the terrestrial is the density. And the density of the seawater is 1,000 times higher than that of the air. And usually everybody thinks about that in terms of how much pressure the organism are suffering at the bottom of the sea, et cetera. But there are other more basic consequences. So because things fall, there is nothing in the atmosphere. Or there might be some bacteria maybe, but there is no life living in the maybe, I don't know, 50, 100, 500 kilometers of atmosphere. So there is nothing, it's all the life in the terrestrial is basically attached to the bottom. However, in the sea, the life starts from 1,000 meters above the bottom. And what you are seeing is the Mont Blanc, that is about 5,000 meters. So the sea is very shallow compared with the atmosphere. The Mont Blanc is taller than the bottom of the sea. And you can see it, you see it as a mountain that you can walk in one day and go and come back. And you never think about that in the ocean, but in compared to the atmosphere, it's really shallow. But it's still 4 kilometers, and that has some consequences. And you can see here the consequences. Basically, is that in the sea, you cannot eat anything that you cannot swallow immediately. I mean, if you kill something and it and you release it, it's going to sink, and then you have to catch it up for 4,000 meters. That doesn't happen in the terrestrial ecosystems. If you kill something, it's going to be in the bottom, and you will have all the time you want to eat it, even if it is very large, and you need time to eat it. In the sea, you need to swallow whatever you find. So this is data that I have collected recently, but I mean, it will be really interesting to go with more data. But this is the comparison between the mass of the predators and the mass of the prey in the sea and in the terrestrial ecosystems. And you immediately can see the differences. This is fish mainly from a paper by Barnes, and the other ones is a combination of two papers, one by Sinclair, one by the Quip. The first obvious is that the predators in the ocean are much larger than predators in the terrestrial ecosystem. So I don't know, a bluefin tuna is 2 times a lion. A killer whale is probably 10 times, and a sperm whale is 200 lions. So that to begin with. The second thing is this triangle you can see here is that in the terrestrial ecosystem, when you are large enough, you don't have predators. So adult elephants, adult rhinoceros, they don't have predators. Nobody can kill them anymore. Whereas in the sea, even whales are killed by other things. And then the other thing is immediately you see also that both the slope and the intercept are different. So basically, with terrestrial predators, you really often see animals that can eat other animals that are larger than themselves. And this is really not the case in general in the ocean. And they can eat usually something that is really almost their size. When in the ocean you eat something, if you look at the differences here, that needs to be quite smaller than you are. And that was for the predators, and it's even more the case for the herbivores. This is a paper by Hansen et al. you can see that the most efficient ones may be the dinoflagellates that are able to suck the substance of things that are almost the size, so that would be the one-to-one. But all other herbivores on phytoplankton are much, much larger than the cells or the prey they are eating. Well, this is the same figure. Whereas in the terrestrial ecosystems, you have a lot of difference. You have things that are much smaller than their prey. So you have insects eating plants that are thousands or millions of times larger than themselves. And then you have all the contrary with very large herbivores that are eating grass that is much smaller than them. So you have a much more contrasting situation. So in general, I mean, one would think that if you have a very large predator prey mass, your efficiency will be lower because you have to make a lot of effort to catch your prey, unless it is very highly concentrated. But here we go to the paper by Hatton et al. I think it's the same paper that Michel Moreau presented before, where you see that in fact, when you look at the biomass of prey and the relation and the concentration of predators and the production, I mean community biomass and production, there don't seem to be that difference between the ocean and the terrestrial ecosystems. So the ratio, the relation between prey biomass and predator biomass seems to be similar in both ecosystems, which is surprising being so different. And I don't know what is the answer, but there might be something stronger underlying reason. The other thing I want to look at, or I'm interested in, is light. And here I didn't even bother looking at the numbers. Seawater attenuation of light is much, much higher than air attenuation. Basically, an eagle could be seeing fish at the bottom of the ocean. Whereas when you are scuba diving, or you wouldn't see a shark 10 meters or 50 meters away from you. So basically there is a very, very large difference in the role of light in the ocean and in the rest of the ecosystems. It's a very, how to say, constraining factor in the ocean. And in addition, it makes another difference in land. Primary production and life are in direct contact. In the ocean, primary production is in the upper 200 meters. All the rest below that are living on falling something, even falling particles, dissolved organic matter, migrations, or whatever, but something that has to come from the surface. But that also makes that it's a place where you can hide. Basically, this is acoustic data from a paper that we published on mesopelagic fish. And what you can see is that depending on the ocean and the productivity of the ocean and the conditions, fishes here will move from the surface. This is mesopelagic fish, about 4 or 5 centimeters long. We move from the surface all the way to 500 meters and come back to the surface at night. So they spend the day in the deep layer to escape predation because it's dark. So they can, basically they are living at night all the time. So this is night, they move down to stay in the night and back. But this implies for this kind of fish that they are moving something like 80,000 body lengths per day just to escape predation. So they are spending apparently a lot of energy going up and down to escape predation. And this is from the same paper, or from another paper, I have to put the reference, where we found out that the position, the average position during the daytime of this fish is related just with the attenuation coefficient of the light in the surface. So basically, if the water is murky or dark because there is a lot of primary production or particles or whatever, they will stay in shallower waters. If the water is very transparent, they will spend the time in much deeper waters. So there is a lot of effort just to escape predation. And this is again what I meant before, because light attenuation, the visual capacity or the capacity of seeing a prey in the ocean decreases really, really fast with distance, much faster than in the upper ecosystem. And then this is something that results from Axnes et al. That are often not considered because we always speak about primary production and these kind of aspects, but they show that the biomass of fish in different areas, in the Black Sea, Norwegian fjords, and I think this is for the Black Sea, is actually related to the light. And why is this? It's basically because it's not only a question of having food in the sea, it's also a question of being capable of seeing the food. So you can have a relatively high concentration of food, but if the water is very dark, your detection ability decreases a lot. So your real food availability is low because you don't see it. And this is even more important the larger the predator becomes. So in fact, this is data that are showing that light is a limiting factor. It's a limiting factor as much as the food concentration in the ocean. But again, we have this paper where apparently the amount of biomass you would get in the ocean per unit of prey or for community biomass of production is about the same. So here I just suggested some ideas about why there might be these differences. It's just guesses, suggestions for things that could be looked at. One is that to me, obviously, the terrestrial food webs seem to be divided into perhaps two. One where you have insects, tree and bird and reptiles, but that does not connect that much with another food web that is the grass, herbivore mammal, carnivore mammals. And there is no such a connection between those food webs. Whereas in the ocean, you have phytoplankton, microzooplankton, crustacean, small fish, large fish, all connected as I think Chris suggested at the beginning in a size structure. And there is lots of predators eating other predators. So copepods are omnivores, anchovies are a predator, a carnivore, mackerels are a carnivore, tuna are a carnivore, sharks are a carnivore, and all those are carnivores eating carnivores. And I don't think that happens in terrestrial ecosystems. And another question is probably whether the plants in the terrestrial ecosystem have evolved and are better to avoid the predation by herbivores or being less digestible than phytoplankton in the ocean. And this is something that could be interesting to look at. And actually this brings to something that has been raised a couple of times already, is whether the evolution of phytoplankton is directed against herbivores, which actually I published a paper some time ago suggesting that. But more recently, I'm thinking more and more that it's more, or at least an important part could be evolution against virus and not the herbivores. If the main source of mortality is virus or a major source of mortality are virus, the evolution of phytoplankton might be more directed or at least partially directed to avoid the mortality due to virus and not that of maybe copepods that are less effective eating them. Well, this was a illustration of the previous idea of with a very connected web in the ocean where predators are eating other predators, and a much, much less connected food webs in the terrestrial ecosystem where you have a very direct connection to grass, large mammal, carnivore, but you don't have, I don't know, you don't have lions eating worms or cats or other medium-sized carnivores, which actually is happening in the ocean. And then just to mention some things that I think are oddities that are not really, they don't have convincing answers about differences between the terrestrial ecosystems and the ocean. There is no insects in the ocean, in the sea. There are some that live in the surface, but they are not living inside the seawater. Although there are in terrestrial aquatic ecosystems, some insects that live in rather saline waters. Mycoplankton, we know very little about it, but doesn't seem to be very abundant. And then there is only two species of floating macroalgae, sargassums, and there is a very low plant biodiversity in the ocean, mangroves, some seagrasses, which to me is quite an interesting question because plants have adapted to almost any ecosystem in land, and they don't seem to have been able to diversify in marine ecosystems. And then some research gaps at sea that I think are worth mentioning, that are some things that we are not looking sufficiently. What is common reception? Probably because diffusivity is lower than in the air, we don't take into account that much the olfactory factors, although we know they are important. Allelopathy is almost not considered, not studied. And again, but I'm happy that viruses came up before in the discussion because I think we know they play an important role. We know that probably as an example are when you have a phytoplankton bloom, they are the main source of mortality in the bloom. But they are almost not included in the models we are using in the ocean. We don't consider them as a source of mortality, or not often. So I think this is something that should be really included in our studies. And with that, I have finished.
Got it. Thanks, Xavier. Interesting ideas in there. Does anybody have questions?
Yeah, I do have maybe a comment. When you present, for instance, the convergence in between terrestrial and an aquatic ecosystem, notably on using graphics from the Hatton et al. Paper, it seems to me that they are not on the same axis, and I wonder if one essential difference is actually that everything is in gram per square meter in terrestrial ecosystem and in gram per integrated square meter or cubic meter for aquatic ones. And for me, what strikes me in terms of aquatic ecosystem is that whatever happens, everything is way more diluted than what you do have on land, where actually all the biomass is in that very thin bio layer, which is, I don't know, 1 meter high, in maximum several meters in forest. But most of the time, if you get on grasslands, then it's less than 1 meter. So basically in terms of density, and that's something that I think we should work on. We actually don't talk about the same units.
Yeah.
When we use marine ecosystem, we talk in concentration or in densities, but when you talk to terrestrial ecosystem, it's not about concentration. And if we want to compare both, we need to move to the same units to get some better insights inside that.
Absolutely, yes. Actually, you are absolutely right, because this is something I did look at, and I think the argument in the paper is that because production in the open ocean is in the surface layer, that would be equivalent. But in my mind, and I didn't have time to look at that, we should also think in terms of, and this is something coming out from the discussion on light, discussion in terms of encounter rate, as an example, that takes into account the dilution that you are mentioning, that is really important in the ocean. So if things are more diluted, and as in addition, you cannot see them, your encounter rates are not the same. And perhaps encounter rate is something that is more realistic or easier to compare. And I don't know anything about encounter rates in the terrestrial ecosystems, but it could be something like of a common unit or a similar approach.
I'll maybe ask you a question, Xavier. You mentioned the low plant diversity in the ocean, which seems possibly to be related to the observation that the photosynthetic organisms on land tend to be green algae or evolved from green algae, like higher plants, whereas in the ocean, the photosynthetic organisms tend to be derived from red algae, the secondary endosymbiont-like diatoms, dinoflagellates, haptophytes, and so on. So sort of the red algal kind of configuration of a chloroplast seems to be favored somehow in the ocean, whereas a green chloroplast type system with two membranes around it seems to be more favored in a terrestrial kind of setting. It's really curious that we see this. I would also classify that as an oddity. I haven't really seen any convincing explanation for why a sort of red chloroplast type would be favored in the ocean, whereas a green would be favored on land. But yeah, I don't know if anyone has anything to say about that.
Yeah. Well, I have no idea on that one. I was more thinking about even the few plants that you have, the seagrasses, as an example. There's very few species, so they don't seem to have been able to diversify, even to occupy the niches they are already occupying. So it's surprising to me that they don't have this diversification and usage of other things. So there are some seagrasses in a few places, but only a few species, very few.
All right, shall we move on if there are no other questions? Thanks, Xavier, it was great. So we'll move on to Sergio Valina, also from Spain, from Gijón.
Hello.
Hi, let's see if you can share your screen.
Should I share my screen or do you upload the PDF? Okay.
Yes, it would be better if you share your screen, yeah.
So let me open up my...
Yeah, because my we're not using my computer here.
Should I wait for you to introduce me? Should I introduce myself? Okay. Right. No problem. Yeah, thank you. I would like to show you my results, our group's results regarding how to use a continuous strait approximation to modeling size diversity in phytoplankton. And this is work in collaboration with, especially with Guillaume Leglon, which is my postdoc. He's working in Barcelona, but we keep working together. Agostino Merico from Germany, Bremen, and Lane Smith in Japan. I spent 2 months with Lane Smith in Japan to start this work as a kickoff. So let's start by saying that we work in the ocean. So at the end, it's a combination of two main models. This is a totally modeling approach, what I'm going to present here. There is no data. And in one side, you have a pool of physiological diversity. In my case, it's planktonic organisms, and so plankton, phytoplankton mostly. You can also have bacteria, eventually viruses, even if it is true that no really global model is including viruses. There is no technical reason not to do it, and it's possible to do. And so you have a combination of how the physiology of the organisms or ecotypes you have in your model combines with the environmental conditions of the ocean, the dispersion, the currents, the temperature, the light levels, etc. This combination leads to a fitness in the terms of the fitness of each ecotype, how fast they can grow in that particular local environment. And therefore, the fastest ones, the ones with the highest fitness, are going to be selected, specially selected, and you're going to end up with a given structure on your community. And finally, there's a feedback between the structure community or ecosystem back to the environment, usually or mostly through the nutrient levels. Mostly is that. You can also have some effects on temperature distribution through light shadowing, but they are minor compared to the major feedback is through changing nutrient conditions in the environment. So that's for the selection part, how a given ecotype or trait, physiological trait, can get selected in a given environment. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the potential for adaptation. So factor of random dynamics in this type of models I presented before usually are fixed traits. They you assume an ecotype with a given set of traits, how they like the temperature of the water, how much light they prefer, are they linear or opportunist regarding the nutrient levels. And once you assign these traits to this ecotype number one, it cannot evolve. And that is not true in nature. In nature, plankton dynamics are affected as well by eco-evolutionary dynamics in the 10 or 20, 30 years. This has been shown before in the lab. And therefore, the models are now starting to catch up and include also this potential effect of adaptation into the traits. So here is a cartoon of a population based on a given phenotype or genotype, they call it here. Let's assume this x-axis is size, for example, of a given cell. So it's a population of phytoplankton cells with different sizes. On the vertical axis is their fitness. In this case, fitness means rate of growth, how much they can grow, like duplication rate. And you can see that in a given environment, you have a size which is optimal, so it's fastest. And there, other phenotypes, which are larger cells or smaller cells, grow a little bit worse or less fast than this optimal phenotype. If you have a drastic change in the environmental conditions all in a sudden, so moving from panel up to panel down, this population might, the cell with the perfect size and these environmental conditions might just collapse when the conditions change. And if your population is basic around that particular cell size, you have a crash of the whole population. In the case B, your population is able to adapt to the changes if the changes on the environmental conditions are comparable of the same speed of the mutation rate. If you have a very drastic change in the environmental conditions, they will not be able to catch up either, even if they are allowed to. But if the changes in the environmental conditions are moderate or slow, basically, you can have a transition from being a given size and then changing your offspring's changing the size compared to the lineage and adapting to the new conditions. So you never have a crash on your population, at least in theory. So we're going to try to simulate this type of behavior. And to do that, I'm going to present the framework, basically. So it's borrowing the framework from physics in which you can solve the same system from two approaches. Imagine you have a gas with many particles, they go in all directions, and you could solve these equations one per molecule and see how is the position going to change, the velocity, how it's pointing, where is it pointing, the mass of each molecule. But that would be an enormous amount of molecules to track. So the system in terms of equations would be very, very large and very computationally expensive and mostly untractable. So you have a secondary approach, which is taking aggregate properties, which is looking at things as a macro world in which you only solve for four equations: the pressure of the gas, its volume, the temperature, and the number of molecules that it has inside. So in this case, even if you change the number of molecules, you will never change the number of equations. You will stick to four equations. But here, if you change the number of molecules, you have to change by the same amount the number of equations. So applying the same mindset to ecological scenarios, in we have a bunch of cells with different sizes. This talk is going to be about phytoplankton size. So let's say we have an ecotype defined with a given size, and you have a many of these ecotypes of many sizes. You could solve the system by doing an equation for each ecotype. And actually we do so. In the Darwin model of Mick Follows, that's the approach that's being used. You have different size classes and you solve an equation for each of them. But a better approach, at least from the time of view, so from the point of view of computational speed, not necessarily more realistic, I think this, the discrete entities, that's the left part, compared to the continuous case, I think the discrete is even better, ecologically speaking, but it's very slow. If you introduce a lot of species in your model, you have to wait a lot to get some simulations. And if you want to do climate change scenarios in the future, that can really get like months of simulation time, which is a lot. So the second approach is taking aggregate properties in which you don't solve an equation for each of the ecotypes in the model as discrete entities, but you take an ensemble. So you solve for the aggregate properties such as total biomass, the mean trait, and the trait variance of the distribution. What is the downfall or the assumption you need to do here is you have to assume in advance the distribution of your population, which is not necessarily in the case with discrete entities. So let's, for example, here to show the same two cases that I showed before. In the upper panels is going to be a community of phytoplankton species with a given trait. Here it says edibility, but in my case, it's going to be size. So this is our size classes. This is a figure given to me by Agostinho Merico some time ago. I never changed it because I like it. And so in the discrete case approach, MIT Darwin approach, you have a given amount, you select in this case, seven ecotypes, and you solve one equation for these seven ecotypes. And you don't assume any particular distribution of the phytoplankton community for that particular trait, in this case, size. The vertical axis is the abundance of each ecotype. So the distribution is an emergent property of the model itself. So it's very more realistic, let's say, than the aggregate model in which you have to impose a priori the distribution of phytoplankton biomass along the axis of cell class. In our case, we're going to assume log normality. I will show you later that this assumption is valid because I'm going to show the two models being solved in parallel. So we are going to see that in case of the discrete entities approach, the upper panel, we get also a log normal distribution. So it's fine to use it as an a priori condition for the continuous state approximation. For the continuous state approximation, you solve for the total biomass, the variance of the distribution, and the change of the mean. This is the mean, sorry, and this is the variance. And the variance is a measure of size dispersion, basically, and therefore is a measure of diversity of sizes. There is a trade-off in the way the size class bins of each phytoplankton takes up nutrient. The trade-off is the traditional linear opportunist trade-off in which you have smaller sizes, which are the blue curves, take up nutrients, which is the x-axis, and the vertical axis is growth. So the blue curves takes up the nutrients faster when they are scarce. So they are the best competitors. Small sizes are the best competitors under nutrient limited conditions. On the other side of the spectrum, you have the red curves, which are the opportunist strategy. They are fastest than anyone else. So the curves are above anyone else when the conditions are plentiful of nutrients. So these are the larger sets like diatoms, etc. And in the middle, you have the two intermediate situations. But basically, I'm assuming a green opportunist trade-off along the size axis from gleaners being the small cells and opportunists being the large cells. Here are a little bit of the equations that I'm going to use in parallel. So the discrete model approach, this is the Darwin type approach. you have one equation for each phytoplankton type, phytoplankton height. So you have, in the previous example, 7 cases if you wish. Some biological interactions. The U is the primary production, G is losses by mortality, and M are losses by background mortality. And an extra term in which you add, or we add, the potential for eco-evo dynamics. That means that you can have that your reproduction is not clonal. If you have a given size, you are not going to be forced to stay in your size. Your offsprings can be larger or smaller of your, the parental line. And the coefficient of mutation is given by this U is the speed of uptake rates, how fast you grow. So the fastest you go, you grow, the more mutations you can have in a given time frame. And then mu x is the mutation rate as such with units of trait squared. So the combination, what we call it mutation coefficient, has units of trait squared divided by day, because u is in day minus one. So if we take this equation and we go back to the previous slide here, basically what it says is you have a dynamical inside this little bar, a given size class, can go up and down regarding on the way they uptake nutrients, primary production, how much they are being grazed on by predators on the top, or the background mortality. But they can also have an outflow towards larger cells or smaller cells through trait diffusion. So when you have a duplication event, a fraction of your cells are going to be larger than the parental line, are going to change size class, and a fraction of your cells are going to be smaller than the parental lines, are going to change size class. These fluxes to other sizes is what is represented here as this trait diffusion approach term. Below, the continuous model is trying to do exactly the same thing I showed before for a discrete case, but in a continuous trait approximation. These equations were derived by my postdoc, Guillaume Leblanc. I'm not going to explain them here, just to keep the concept that they are exactly mimicking, in a continuous trait approach, what is in the discrete case. But instead of having to solve as many equations as ecotypes of the discrete type in your model, you only solve for 3 equations, which are the change in mean size, in this case, mean trait, in our case is size, the variance of the size, that means the diversity, and the total phytoplankton. I didn't mention that we are assuming log normality. I don't know if I said this is Gaussian or not, but this is Gaussian in log size. So in fact, it's a skewed distribution, but when you take the log, it becomes normal. And we're working on always with here x is log size. Our trait is in log size. Here a little bit of what is the environmental conditions. It's a vertically resolved modeling exercise in which you have 1 year. So the x-axis is from January to December, a climatological year. A vertical axis is depth from 0 to 200 meters. You have a seasonal change in PAR, photosynthetic active radiation, a seasonal change in temperature, and a seasonal change in turbulence. This is mixing water mixing in the column water. In the white line is the mixing layer depth in this particular idealized case. This is a very idealized scenario, probably similar to conditions of mid-latitude like Sargasso Sea. These are the simulations you obtain with the 2 models in parallel. So the upper panels are for the continuous trait approximation and the lower panels are for the discrete approximation. So the lower panels are Darwin type model and upper panels are the approximation to the Darwin type model. So we're going to take into account as the reality, even if it's also a model, that the best model is a discrete case. And we want to evaluate if the continuous trait approximation works well enough to be able to be substituted in global ocean scenarios for the global warming, et cetera, in the future, of the traditional discrete entities approach. We can see, again, x-axis is time in month, and vertical axis is depth. For the total biomass, perfect match. Both types of approximation works very well. For the mean size, good match. The continuous entity approach probably overestimates a little bit the seasonality on the changes in the mean size, but it captures very, very well the seasonality. And for the diversity or sigma of the distribution, it also very well captured. So we were very pleased by the fact that the continuous state approximation is able to capture very well the traditional discrete entities approach. Here I'm going to show the same results, but only for the surface, so you can see it a little bit probably more intuitively. So I'm showing here just the first point on in depth, the first layer. On the left side, the continuous approach. On the right side, the discrete entities approach. X-axis is size, log size in this case. The values are size in microns, but the scale is logarithm. Vertical axis is biomass of the different size classes. And the colors represent the seasonality. So you go from 1st of January in blue up until the mid of July in red. So you have a transition basically from in winter, large cells and small, a given variance. And in summer, cells getting smaller, the mean, and the variance getting slightly larger. So you have an increase as well in diversity of sizes. You see the same thing for the discrete and the continuous, because the continuous is approximating very well the discrete entities approach. And in the work that Guillaume is doing and has just been published, he extended this framework for two traits, not only cell size, but you can also have other traits. He added temperature optima, so you have mutagenesis, if you wish, into traits. In his case was the nutrient optima, greener opportunist trade-off again, and the temperature optima at the same time. So you have combinations of genes affecting nutrient optima and combination of genes, if you wish, affecting temperature optima in a two fitness landscape. And selection and evolution is just basically trying to climb up this 2D surface and try to be the fastest. So fitness is, in our definition, is a speed of growth, and you're trying to reach the fastest growth you can. So you are going to outcompete your peers if you manage to evolve and get faster than anyone else. This is the paper I have just talked about. I didn't discuss this particular paper because I thought that talking about one trait was simpler than going into the 2D, but basically this framework here, this paper, encompasses what I did before, what I explained before. So you can see the details here for two traits, which is an extension of the one trait scenario. So as a summary, we've shown that the continuous size approximation, continuous trait in my case is size approximation to do eco-evo simulations is working pretty well. It's able to approximate quite well the traditional discrete size approach of the Darwin model. Multi-traits are possible, and Guillaume Leblanc is working on that, and we have just published a paper with two traits, but he's now working on the third trait, which will be irradiance optima. So the idea was to have all these three traits, like nitrogen greener opportunist trade-off or nitrogen optima, one trait, second one temperature optima, and third one light optima, because these three are the major traits that dominate the phytoplankton community in the ocean. We are also working, when I said we are, is Guillaume Leblanc. He's taking the lead on this project. He's combining these two approaches as well of the discrete entities with the continuous case in a way that you can have, that each population has its own variants, and therefore you can have a multi-population continuous case. I don't know if I explained myself properly, but that's what I wanted to say. And we are going to finally couple that to a global ocean simulation. Actually, he's doing that this week with the aim of having a global change scenarios for the future to see if running the model without any potential to mutate, so keeping just the species being fixed in terms of the traits, versus doing it with an array of mutation values, having eco-evo in the model, does it change our estimates of biological pump or biogeographic distribution of phytoplankton, etc. There is many questions you can answer while you have an eco-ego model in place. And with that, I thank you all for listening.
Thanks, Sergio. Here I am.
You're welcome.
May I ask a question, Sergio?
Yes, please, Maurizio.
Oh, thank you, Sergio. This assumes that that you define since the beginning the trait space. So you have to know which is the kind of trait you are working on. You cannot
trait space. It's usually in the models I'm used to, at least in the ocean, is defined in a 3D setup. Of course, there are more dimensions that are not included. But the three dimensions of niche that are that the rock bed of the model are nutrient gradient, values of nutrient conditions and concentrations, temperature gradient, and irradiance gradient. Of course, there is in nature many dimensions like pH, toxins. These are not included in this type of models that we are working with.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hello, Sergio. Hi, it's Marina. Thank you very much. It was a great, great presentation. I really like this new approach that you have. I have maybe technical questions about your model. The first in the Darwin type model, so the discrete model, you have this diffusion. Trait diffusion. I didn't really understand what X meant. You derive by X. X is the trait.
Yeah, let me show you. I have to share again, right? Share screen.
Like, do you? And so my question related to this is: do you ensure like mass conservation with this trait diffusion?
There is no conservation here. Actually, that's a question. Very good question, technically speaking, because I had the same question myself. I was using before working with Guillaume Leblanc, I was using this equation, but with the K being outside.
Mm-hmm.
So it was outside the second derivative.
Yes.
So it was basically the same equation as you would use with a tracer, in which you have a diffusion of a tracer.
Mm-hmm.
In which KZ vertically changing, imagine X is Z.
So what is X? What is X?
X is this one here, is the mutation rate.
No, but X, what is the dimension X? Is this trait? It's
log
trait?
Size. Log size.
But it's trait, okay.
Trait, yeah. We're working on that axis here, on the X axis here.
But so trait is like I, because you have one trait per type.
Trait is like I, yes. I might be, maybe it's confusing the fact that I kept both. I should have put X all over, probably. Yes, it's the same thing. It's equivalent at the end, yes. It's a given.
Mm-mm. And so,
but I thought you were asking me another thing, the conservation of mass.
Yeah.
In the case in which you have conservation, so the amount of tracer going from box one to box two, it also matches the amount of mass going through diffusion from box two to box one.
Yes.
If you have KZ is outside of the second derivative. But in this case, because it's a matter of how many cells change size, there is no need to have this symmetry, because it depends on the speed at which each species is growing. So you have to have it in the second derivative. And this is something that Guillaume explained to me. I didn't know that. So he found out that.
Okay.
There is no, this constraint of conservation is not happening here. There is no this constraint of mass conservation.
Okay.
Because we are not dealing with mass. We're dealing with a property which is not conserved.
It reminds me of a similar problem, but I can't remember which one. But whenever I will remember, I will tell you. I will email you. And so this term in the continuous model, it's somehow implicit somewhere.
Here.
Where is it?
Here.
Okay.
Yeah, U is here, so it's here.
Okay.
So basically, the mu x is the length of change that a mutation event has in trait square. And then by multiplying that by the speed of changes, not changes, the speed of divisions, like the growth rate, you get the same units as the traditional turbulent coefficient that you use in turbulent diffusion, right?
I think it's a very promising approach. It's quite, if I remember well, it's quite different from what, you know, what's the Boris Sautré. You remember his model with evolution? It was formulated in a very different way.
He has to replace organisms, right? He had to, when they were, he had a mutation on a given ecotype.
And then it was more of a discrete model that he had with like the number of the plankton growing exponentially with time, as you were creating new traits. And I think your approach is very promising for coupling with 3D ocean models. Yeah, have you started doing that?
Yes, Guillaume Leglon is working on that.
Yeah. Okay.
Because Guillaume Leglon, at the end, he has a background of math. He's kind of your type of grand école, etc. No, you did Polytechnique. He did, I think, ENSTA Paris.
He was working with Olivier Aumont, no? I think he was working with Olivier Aumont.
With Olivier. He has been with us for 2 years now, and he's starting a project with Raphael Simon and ERC project as well. He's going to keep working with us for at least for another 2 years. And we're really very pleased with him, not only because he's a really very, very bright, probably one of the brightest minds I have encountered in my life. He's also a very nice person to work with. And so we are, I'm learning a lot by working with Guillaume Leglon in this project, because I had previously only working with a trait diffusion in discrete case, but I was getting more interested in doing continuous trait approximation from my conversations with Lannesmith, etc. And so I came back from Japan working on 1D, but Guillaume said I can do it multi-trait. And then he started to work on multi-trait, and he said that now he has working also the 3-trait approach. And this week we are working on coupling it to the MIT ECM. So I'm looking forward to it. But I have to credit Guillaume for a vast majority of the continuous part of this work is basically his work. So I really congratulate him for his mental capabilities. And,
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks, Sergio. I guess we should move on in the interest of time. And so Gérard Lacroix will be presenting next. I think we have a computer changeover. Hopefully you know what to do. So Gérard is a colleague of mine at the École Normale, working in aquatic ecology.
So here, my presentation will be a little bit different from the others, because I didn't want to present results, but more to make some remarks on some aspects associated to the experimental study on the links between ecosystem structure and function in aquatic ecosystems. And for that, I will take part of my function, which is to coordinate an experimental platform near Paris. So I just wanted to take a few examples in aquatic freshwater ecosystems on aspects associated to experiments. And first, I wanted to say that a lot of experimental approaches have been done on the coupling between community structure and ecosystem function. But most of these approaches in freshwater systems were associated to pelagic simplified systems. And I did also several experiments on these pelagic parts of ecosystems, in spite of the fact that much of these systems were very shallow and small. And in fact, probably the functioning of these systems were strongly associated to littoral and benthic areas. But it was ignored because, in fact, in most cases, we did not have a size for the
teams who work on these systems to work on all the compartments which were clearly linked in these systems. Also, so a lot of actors in ecosystem functioning are very frequently neglected in approaches on the coupling between community and functioning. For example, if you take the aquatic vascular plants, they have been considered to have a minor importance for herbivores until the 1990s. And also, a lot of theories and also a lot of experiments on bottom-up and top-down interactions were based on the classical green food web and did not include the brown web. And also, in global approaches on the link between community, structure, and ecosystem function, the quality of resources is rarely taken into account. There have been a lot of developments on ecological stoichiometry, but they were rarely at the level of complex food webs. Another aspect associated to approaches on aquatic systems and also on experimental systems was associated to the fact that there was a strong hierarchy based on body size for food web architecture. We have a lot of information on that, which clearly show that relationships are size dependent, and also there are interesting aspects which show that when we compare terrestrial and aquatic systems, the fact to be in three dimensions or two dimensions is also very important. And this information was taken, in fact, from large databases, which describe a lot of food webs. And these informations allow to analyze the allometric scaling relationship between predator and prey body mass. And one conclusion, which was given by in the paper of Brose et al., a recent paper, indicates that the predator traits are much more important than the prey traits in determining these relationships. In fact, when we looked at the traits and the database which are used, we can see that we have some limitations in these aspects. These limitations are on most global approaches are associated to the fact that the interacting individuals have, in general, population average body masses, and the relationships are not derived from the actual body masses of the interacting individuals. This fact seems to be perhaps not important, but in fact, there have been some studies which have shown that we can make an error which is around one order of magnitude according to the size ratio of predator and prey when we consider mean averages. In fact, population averages. Also, we sometimes have a lack of individual data, for example, ontogenetic diet shifts, which are not always taken into account, for example, for fish, where we can have very large variation in size and also in type of prey with ontogeny. And last, the feeding behavior of consumers is not frequently taken into account. In fact, if you take a similar size roach, Rutilus rutilus, and a similar size perch, you will have something like one order of magnitude also in difference in size ratio, despite the fact that the consumers have the same size. And also, networks are biased toward more visible organisms, and some types of interactions are frequently not taken into account, for example, parasites, etc. And so there is a challenge of assessing all or at least a large fraction of the food web links. Perhaps we might say that it is not important and that we are used to deal with the more important components of the food webs, of the communities. I just want to say an example of an experiment I did some years ago, and we published, in fact, our results. And when we published our results, we did not take into account the fact that we had some epibions on zooplankton. These epibions were mainly Colassium, belongs to the genus Colassium, which are Euglenophysae, which are primary producers. And some years after, we decided to make some counting. And we observed, I don't want to enter into the details, but it was an experiment with fish and without fish. And you can see that in all the treatments without fish, all the pelagic cells in the systems were planktonic, in fact, in systems dominated by planktivorous fish. But when you look on the results associated to the enclosures without fish, you can see that a large part of the primary producers live, in fact, attached to the zooplankton. And in most cases, they are ignored when people looked at zooplankton, phytoplankton interaction. Here, on the right, I just put the results for one enclosure, which was particularly dominated by epibions in the systems, where primary producers represented more of half of the community in terms of abundance. So it is just to say that perhaps what is important and what is negligible is not so evident. Perhaps there might be some other ways in order to have a better view of all the organisms which are present in our systems. For example, there are very promising approaches in order to construct co-occurrence networks from eDNA metabarcoding. But with such approaches, we mainly have co-occurrence information networks. And the challenge is to switch from co-occurrence networks to interaction networks. One idea might be to link eDNA approaches and other approaches based on all the previous knowledge on interactions between organisms. In order to begin that, we tried to construct a database which informs as much as possible the links between organisms in aquatic ecosystems. This database will be accessible in the next year to the world scientific community. It will be accessible through ANAE France infrastructure. And this database gives information on the links between in freshwater or marine communities between a large variety of organisms, and we try as much as possible to have information at an individual level in order to allow to have better knowledge on the real interactions according to size, for example, and also to take also into account other aspects. For example, we try as much as possible to take aspects of behavior, taxonomy, life history traits, etc. When we have such these types of information, it is possible with detailed community structure to build, in fact, probabilist food webs. And after that, to work with these food webs in order to better understand how they are constructed. And for example, here you can see an example where we try to look at food webs which were used in a mesocosm experiment. And we tried in these experiments to define the main trophic group levels, but ad posteriori and not a priori. And also to see the, how these food webs can be simplified in distinct modules, so main vertical pathways of energy flows. And this is one aspect, which is probably that in the next year, it will be easier for us to have more realistic interaction networks. After that also, there is a necessity to take into account the ecosystem complexity. I said, yeah, I think it's the same. Okay, so I will switch to the other slide. This is rather similar to the first one. So in order to do that, one necessity is perhaps to deal at different complexity levels, to be able to work on very simplified systems in order to understand the processes, and after that to construct some medium-sized ecosystems, but also to accept to deal with large-scale and long-term experiments. We try to propose this type of facilities in the CEREP Ecotron Île-de-France, so which is a unit of services near Paris, and where in this unit of services we build some platforms, aquatic platforms, which deal from the small microcosms to the some large, I would say, macrocosms. There are something like more than 700 cubic meters in volume. And it is possible with these systems to deal with communities, with top predators, which are really piscivores, and which are able to have their own dynamics. So it is also a progress when we compare that to what was done before. And also it is we have a very precise information on the dynamics of the populations in these artificial lakes. It's a long-term experiment, and it is not so simple in the systems in which we work. We have also a lot of information which are associated to automated sensors, which allow us, for example, to estimate, for example, lake metabolism each day, etc. And so, in conclusion, I would just like to say here that perhaps we have now some tools which allow us to be more optimistic according to the study of the links, the experimental study of the links between community structure and ecosystem functioning. First, there are the developments of new approaches, and if we are able to integrate these approaches, such as eDNA, large information database on traffic lights, and etc., it is probably possible for us to have much more precise interaction networks. Also, it is now possible to use new tools in order to better look at organism functions. And last, we have the development of a large variety of sensors which allow us to have new information, such as, for example, the lake metabolisms. Which significates also that we switch from rather experiments which are rather easier to maintain and to control to much large systems, and also we switch toward big data, and it is also a challenge. For that, we need greater collaborations and also greater mutualization, in particular mutualization for the large-scale, long-term experiments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard. Do we have any questions from online?
I wonder for the aquatic web database,
The
repertoire, it will be one that will be aquatic in large definition, meaning marine and
In fact, this database is the aim is to deal with most aquatic species, whatever they are. But at this time, we have a bias because I am a limnologist. And first, I began to work on zooplankton and fish, etc., and phytoplankton on lakes. And we entered also some information on marine systems, but we are just at the beginning. But the systems will be totally open to people, and they will have a possibility to enrich the database. The database is based only on scientific published papers. And so it is a huge work of analysis. At this time, we entered more than 700 papers. So it's a long time to do that. But also, we have a lot of information.
Okay. Because there is already some existing database.
Yeah, there are some existing database. One difference is that these databases are in most cases, it is not always the case, but in most cases, they are based on food webs. They describe a large variety of food webs. And here, we choose to describe individual links.
Yeah.
With as much possible information on very specific links, in order for people after that to build their own food web.
Okay. And I wonder if one critical information that I don't think I've seen there is about the some level of stoichiometry of organisms, because depending on the organism that you look that you are looking for, they may have some very specific chemical properties, including water stoichiometry, which could be very vital to include.
Yeah, at this time, the stoichiometric characteristics of organisms are not entered in the database, but we thought about that. We did not have the time to fill this this point, but we want to deal with that, in fact. I did some works before on stoichiometry, and I know it is important to deal with that. But yeah, it's not done at this time.
Okay, I guess we should move on in the interest of time, because we need to stop at 6:30 French time because of the curfew. So Fabien, it's you next, Fabien Lombard. I'm happy to introduce to everybody. He's a colleague working on the Tara Oceans project since some time, and he works at the Villefranche Oceanography Station in the south of France, and will be talking to us about trophic structure in marine ecosystems. So yeah, looks good. All over to you.
So I will talk to you about some results that we've got from Tara Ocean expedition, and on which we focused our effort to try to understand what are the size, the trophic, and the functional structure of planktonic ecosystem, and on which we've got some pretty interesting results, notably by discovering some very high importance of gelatinous plankton and predators. So just to briefly introduce you, the way we constructed all that, we started to construct everything based on the principle of the size structure of ecosystem, where basically you have a high abundance of small guys, and the more you move toward large organisms, then their size increase, but their number decrease. And this is usually a very constrained and conserved function that you have all over the spectra of size, on which we can basically look for the ecosystem on a general rule. And that rule have interesting properties, such as the slope of that relationship, because if we have ecosystem that are very high abundance of small guys, but very low abundance of large guys, that means that there is a very low transfer of energy from small to large organisms, if we take the assumption that large eats the small ones. And of course, if there is a lot of big ones compared to the small ones, then we have high efficiency of transfer of energy along the trophic chain. And of course, all that is supposed to be related to the trophic structure of the ecosystem. If we have something which is pretty flat like that, in terms of biomass, we should await something which could approach inverted EV top trophic pyramids. But when we have something which is very steep like that, then we have a lot of phytoplankton, then very few herbivores, and of course, very low amount of carnivores. And one of the major, that's supposed to be the theory. First of all, that's something that have never been verified. And secondly, there is something that's always puts in my mind, which is when you look for the trophic structure of the ocean, you can always find both observation or both schematic view of the trophic structure of the ocean. And if you read the literature, there is huge amount of publications that states that half of the biomass is, let's say, bacteria or phytoplankton or so on. And basically, we don't know exactly which structure is the true one. And that's something that we try to look at the level of the ecosystem. And that's something which is that is also true even in recent bibliography. And that's just an extract of one of those that clearly don't believe that bottom heavy, that top heavy pyramids can exist, and assume that depending on the transfer efficiency and the size difference in between predator and prey, normal pelagic ecosystem should be bottom EV, but not top EV. And basically, when we done the Tara Ocean expedition, we use a lot of different kind of quantitative imaging devices from flow cytometry, then using different confocal microscopes or IFCB or FlowCam, ZoScan, and UVP to basically capture the food ecosystem from point one to several centimeters in size, which if we put that in context, is the same size difference as in between insects of 1 centimeter and several kilometers above the mountain that the insect lies on. So basically, we were looking for very large scale. And thanks to that, then we were able to capture the full abundance of the organism in the ecosystem. So that's normalized biovolume size spectra, which is basically something very equivalent to abundances. And that's the different colors, that's the different machines that we were using. And here, that's just one station from Tara Ocean. And we were using that property to basically reassemble all the observation in just one meta product that we can, after all, interrogate to get the full size structure. But also, because we have identified the plankton that are beside, we can tell what is the functional structure for that. And because we know about their trophic level, because we have the taxonomy, then we can even assess the trophic structure for that. So basically, we have one product, but we can look together from that product, the size, the functional, and the trophic structure. And what we got out of that, so basically, that's a polar ecosystem, that's a polar part of the expedition, on which we were able to look at that from 0.8 to centimeter scale, and that's the slope of that decreasing relationship. So basically, we are looking for the size structure. And here, that's the same one, but looking for the trophic slope. So basically, the slope when fitted on those histograms. And the first thing that we see here is basically we are looking for the same kind of signal, and both signals are highly correlated. So basically, we confirm that size and trophic structure, at least at the level we are looking at, do correlate massively. And secondly, when you look for the colors, here that green color, that's when the ecosystem is supposed to be flat, or yellow in that one. And basically, most of the data points are either yellow or heavily orange, but are never or nearly never in the blue range. So basically, the full ecosystem is totally either flat or EV top. And that's something that we classify there. When we look for just the size spectra, the full ecosystem is either top EV or flat. When we look at the trophic slope, there is much more bottom EV that appears, but still the full ecosystem is still dominated by predatory ecosystem. When we look at higher scale for the rest of the Tara Ocean expedition, here we are only looking from 20 micrometer to centimeter size because we don't have the full range of imaging devices that we were using in the polar ecosystem. But we get the same relationship when we look for the size structure. And when we look for the trophic structure, then we have again a high dominance of EV top ecosystem and still a high correlation in between both. So basically all those signals display the same properties, which is an ecosystem which is heavily dominated by predator-dominated ecosystem. When we look for the functional structure here, so that's in the polar ecosystem, and here that's the global mean at the polar ecosystem. And what you can see here is that we were awaiting ecosystem highly dominated by diatom in green and copepod here in blue. They are there sometimes in some station, but they are not the ones that really dominate the ecosystem at large scale. That's much more those pinkish guys, which are basically filter feeders, tunicates that are filtering the seawater, or some levels of predators like ketognaths or cnidarians and ctenarians that dominate about 30% of the total biovolume at that level. And we get the same results looking for the rest of the ocean with the additions of rhizarians that are mostly observed in the tropics. So basically, we have an ecosystem which is dominated where one third of the ecosystem is basically gelatinous guys, gelatinous predators or consumers that dominate the ecosystem. And that's something that is sometimes known. So there is some few publications, including one that I won't comment too much because I guess we will talk about that one later on today. But basically, from the records that exist that have tried to compile most of the biomass in the marine ecosystem, that's something that we should await globally with something dominated by consumers or predators. And using some ecological models, that's what we should observe, that's something dominated by EV top ecosystem. But what is also very interesting there is that we can also reconcile a contradictory approach, because what we observe is actually that we got those EV biomass of gelatinous plankton. And if we get more information about, let's say, the predator to prey size ratio, those gelatinous filter feeders, they are nearly at the same level or encompassing the size differences that we can get for whales, still getting very high clearance rate. And that's the same for jellyfishes that I didn't show on the graph there. But basically, if we replace those two guys, then we are lying somewhere here in that graph. So basically, just because gelatinous plankton are gelatinous, then they offer possibilities to reconcile all that because they have such a highly skewed predator to prey size ratio and they can still feed on very large amount of seawater, then they can explain all that. So relatively to what Michel Leroux has shown, we have observed something very similar again with basically the, depending on the, so here we have two couples of predators on prey. So we have the herbivorous that feed on the autotrophs or the carnivores that feed on the heterotrophs or on the herbivorous. And basically when we look at the ecosystem that way, then the full ecosystem is organized on the same similar trend that don't obey to a kind of allometry. So of course, when we have a lot of prey, then we have a lot of predators, but that relationship between the both are skewed. And that's something that, of course, have been observed in between microbes and their viruses, but up to predators on between lions and antelopes in the African savanna. And when we play with that unity relationship, which is there, then we can await basically that draft to be situated somewhere there. And that's, I guess that's totally due to the fact that we are dealing with environments that are less diluted than in the seawater. So we are looking for the same relationship. We are just looking it at different dilution states. When we analyze a little bit more deeply the functional composition of that ecosystem, then there is some other things that do appear. So basically, that's a principal component analysis on composition. And basically, what we get is that the full data set that we have that encompasses the full ocean is basically this spiking three state in the ecosystem. We have one ecosystem which is highly dominated by diatoms with very low trophic slopes, so basically bottom EV ecosystems. Then we have on that scale something with high trophic slope, so totally inverted ecosystem that are either dominated by gelatinous carnivores on one side and on the other side by rhizarians, ketognaths, and large crustaceans. Basically, in that system, we can distinguish four groups of stations. And if we just play to get the composition of those ones, then we have that group, which we still have a lot of diatoms. Then we have the second group, which is in the middle, which is pretty flat in terms of structure, which is much more equilibrated. And then when we go to the two ones that have high trophic slopes, then we have the one which is dominated by ketognaths and rhizarians, and the second one which is dominated by gelatinous guys, either carnivores or filter feeders. So basically, we have that gelatinous plankton, and when we just draw the trophic slope as a function of the percentage of gelatinous plankton, then we have a clear relationships that do emerge, which means that basically they are the one that we can get the same one by just drawing the diatoms, because the diatoms are doing the inverse relationship to gelatinous plankton. But basically here we have an ecosystem where the trophic slope, the trophic state of the ecosystem is dominated by a bipole in between diatoms on one side and gelatinous plankton on the other side. And together with that, we have those copepods that basically are always something in between 25% and 30% of the ecosystem, which is something quite a constant. So copepods are constant, but they are not necessarily the ones that control the trophic state of the full ecosystem. When we play with the environment on top of that, basically we can describe those ecosystems there as having high chlorophyll, high flux, high primary production. So basically we have environment on that side that are pretty eutrophic. And we have those ones that are basically totally tropical oligotrophic systems. So basically that trophic slopes that we've seen before, and together with the total biovolume, which is there, and I'm sorry, I forgot to remove that, is basically not really related to the eutrophic to oligotrophic, because the trophic slope is going on that direction. So that's something which is decoupled from the level of eutrophy of the ecosystem. So we can have eutrophic and predator-dominated ecosystem, or we can have eutrophic, like start of a bloom or upwelling ecosystem that are totally bottom EV. And when we relate that to the carbon flux, basically we have those kind of ecosystems that can have high carbon flux to the bottom. And then we have those two ecosystems that have high trophic efficiency toward higher level, and that one being still associated with high fluxes in the seawater. So basically to wrap up, We've seen that planktonic ecosystem is globally top EV, but we still have some bottom EV situation, notably when we have upwellings, when we are at the beginning of a bloom, when we are close to the sea ice margin, when we are on the polar ecosystem. And that signal is basically confined by the trophic and both the size structure of the ecosystem. We've seen that we have a direct link in between functional composition of diatoms on gelatinous plankton that play a critical role. And we believe that it's because all those gelatinous guys, they are pretty good at shortcutting the food chain because of that highly skewed predator to prey ratio, together with other properties like the decoupling in lifetime difference that they could have versus their prey. We've seen that copepods are still something very constant in ecosystem, but that's not the one that are associated with trophic structure on carbon flux. And secondly, we've seen again that trophic structure on carbon flux are not something coupled, but that's the functional composition, which is very important. And on that, I will stop.
Thanks, Fabien. Superb. Marina is coming for a question right away, so I'll hand it over.
Thank you, Fabien. It was very nice. I was wondering if you had replotted back the three states of your ecosystem on a map. Do you have like a regionalization of the three states?
I don't have it on that presentation, unfortunately, but yes, I have plotted it. And that's something which is, I ask you to trust me.
Yes.
That group is mostly tropical.
Okay.
But what is very surprising is that often those groups on those groups, they are regionally very coupled. As if we see a bloom spatially etalated. So that's not something, and that group is much more coastal most of the time.
Okay.
But yes, we look at that, but that's something which there is no very, I would say, latitudinal gradient except for that group, which is clearly tropical. Mm-hmm. All the other ones, they are basically mixed, and they could be very closely associated, notably on those two ones, when this is a bloom that gets aged, and basically that's the predators that arrive and then start to control the bloom.
Okay, I have another question, which is... maybe you've said this, but even though you cover a large range of scales, you don't go up to fishes and large predators. And I was wondering if you think that the shape could, you know, reverse depending if you go higher in the trophic web or not. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
I will say yes and no. I would say yes when we are on a case of local instabilities like blooms that actually propagate in the trophic chain. They may propagate further in fish, but we still have that problem that the lifetime of those guys, they are much more of large fish or even jellyfish. They are more long than their prey. So basically, you can have local instabilities that touch the lower level of trophic chain, but the larger guys act as a buffer. So basically, you will have something that will oscillate on the small size, but not necessarily on the large size.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Fabien. I have two questions. One is about the carbon content of jellyfish, because is the size compensating for a lower carbon content or is wrong?
It compensates in a way, but not totally, and it don't change the picture. So here you have the same one, which is calculated using carbon to biovolume ratio, which are far from being perfect. But we still have those ecosystems that have up to 20%. Sometimes look globally on the ocean, we are still at 15% of gelatinous plankton in carbon biomass.
Okay. And then the second question is about the link between jellyfish and diatoms. Do you think that diatoms developed some capability of resist to grazing by jellyfish? Because this is an hypothesis that Viktor Smetasek put forward long ago. And we would justify this sort of dichotomy. Either you have jellyfish or you have diatoms.
Yeah, well, I don't know if there is a resistance of diatoms toward jellyfish. There is some very few species of jellyfish, notably the coastal ones, that can prey on diatoms, on ciliates, on all this kind of stuff. But they are not the ones that are observed there. But one thing which is sure is that there have been a paper that have been published last week showing that all those jellyfish, they are tightly associated with bacteria that actually help to better recycle the NH4 in NO2 and NO3. And basically, jellyfish may certainly enhance the recycling of nutrients, notably nitrate. And in such a case, if there is much more nitrate, then we can await phytoplankton that don't depend on other source of nutrients like silicates, like diatoms do, to better cope with that. But except from that, I don't await jellyfish to highly eat diatoms.
Maybe I can just add something there. I mean, jellyfish, we think about jellyfish, no, but obviously diatoms do clog the filters of the appendicularians, doriolites, and so in a way, yeah, they have a resistance in the sense that they clog the filter and they don't allow them to eat the smaller things they need to eat. So there is some kind of, I don't know if you call that a defense, but an antagonism between diatoms and the filter feeder gelatinous organisms.
Yeah.
And a couple of things, Fabian, well, what you mentioned, there is an issue on the time scale between larger one fish and the variability of the smaller one. But maybe looking at the areas where it's more or less stable, the lower part of the trophic food chain.
Yes, it's
the biomass of the fish is also something possible to get from. I mean, there is other data that could be used to try to have something there.
Yeah, when we look for the so maybe that's something that we can see already. Let's say on that graph if you look for the variation in terms of quantity of predators, that's something which is pretty invariant, and that's not where you have the higher variability. The higher variability actually came from the base.
Yeah.
So basically, we have a standing stock of predators that are there, and the fact that the pyramids get EV top or not is mostly due to the variations of the base rather than on the variations of the top.
The top, yeah. And I would say also that probably in the top, you even have more than that because the large crustaceans are probably not properly estimated with.
Yeah. And here I'm working only on the daytime collection. Because we have very few nighttime collection of plankton on which we don't necessarily have all the migrants. And knowing that everything was going to a EV top pyramid, I wanted to keep something which is as conservative as possible. Mm-hmm. And I prefer it to get a bias that I know in which direction it goes rather than one which is unknown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Could I ask a quick question, following up on Maurizio's question about the gelatinous animals? I'm thinking of the Baran et al. Paper of a few years ago, where they show that land plants dominate biomass on land, but something like 90% of that biomass is non-living cells. So you have to think about it in an unusual way. And so I'm wondering, in these gelatinous animals, what percentage of the carbon is actually metabolically active, and does it matter?
That's something that we can already see when we transform the results from, so let's get that one. That's the same one that I presented, except that those two ones, they are in carbon. So this is carbon. Mm-hmm. And this is biovolume. That's the same one in biovolume. So you see that there is higher amount of water in those organisms because, of course, they are gelatinous, which means that they are composed of heavy percentage of water. So they are not as metabolically active as other ones, but they are still there. And more importantly, everything depends on what process you want to look. If you are looking for the respiration, then yes, we have to look for the carbon weight. If we want to focus on how much those ones are eating, that's not the carbon biomass that we need to look. That's their actual size or their actual biovolume. So basically, they are eating a lot while they are respiring very few.